Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It's a free download and you can go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. That's firmsconsulting with an S.com/overall approach. And if you are looking to advance your career and need to update your resume, you can get a McKinsey and BCG winning resume template as a free download at www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. That's www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. Welcome, Venkat. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
So there's many, many things we could discuss, but I had a discussion with your very good friend and colleague, Vijay, and he was telling me about some of the work you've now been doing that has built off some research questions you've been asking over the last 20 years or so. As a starting point for our listeners, maybe give us the summary of their thinking.
Great question to get started. I think when I started at MIT Sloan School in 1985 as an assistant professor of strategy,
yes,
I was fortunate to be part of a research project that was unusual in the sense that, unlike research projects that look back, this was a research project that was looking forward. Mm-hmm. And the project was called Management of the 1990s. And the central question was, how will the discipline of management change because of information and communication technologies?
Yes.
Now, you got to remember that in 1985, the best piece of hardware we had was an IBM PC with a green screen with a prompt. And the best piece of software we had was Lotus 1-2-3. We had not gotten graphical user interface. Computers were not connected. We had no idea what the internet was going to become. But the central question of how will information technology change the discipline of management was an intriguing question.
Yes.
Now, fast forward to 2024. It's the same question in the minds of management consultants, analysts, strategy practitioners, and many, many MBA students. How will the discipline of management change because of digital technologies, except that the arsenal of technologies that we have now is far greater, much more powerful, and more robust than the piece of PC that we had in the 1980s? But to me, that's still the most central question as a strategy researcher working at the intersection with digital technologies, as well as many practicing executives who are really asking the question, how far have we come in this transition away from the industrial age thinking, the industrial age mindset that permeate how people think about strategy, organization, business models, and then competitive strategy, to a more post-industrial age, if you will, with digital, in our case, data and AI at the core of transformation of industries, adaptation of strategies, and reinvention of business models that are central pretty much every industry everywhere in the world today.
It would seem that's a very broad mandate, and we'd have to segment it because obviously some industries like banking, for example, they've been very adept at using AI, cloud, and technology to serve customers. Of course, consumers, we've been exposed to things like iPhones and lots of new technology, Uber apps and so on. But I would think there are some sectors and some industries that have not been as skilled at using technology. Is that the case?
Yeah, and I think it's a good way to think about segmentation has been to look at industries that we call as asset light.
Yes.
And industries that are more asset heavy. If you look at asset light industries, for example, banking, advertising, music, media and entertainment, telecom, publishing, video games, these industries have had, I would say, 15 to 20 years of digitization.
Yes.
Where much of what we saw in the analog world has become digital. Books, classic example, movies, media, and so on, the analog artifacts have become digital. Now, if you look at the next wave of transformation, is asset-heavy sectors, which is going to be transformed with physical plus digital. Maybe the value shift from physical to digital is just in the early stages of that transformation. And here I'm referring to transportation, agriculture and farming, mining, construction, healthcare, logistics, energy. These are all industries where we're still going to have lots of physical artifacts, machinery and equipment, buildings and construction, energy grids, hospitals, and so on. But the relative value may shift from physical to digital. And that's where I think the interesting challenge for many, many analysts and many, many strategy professionals to think about. At the same time, the logic that worked in the asset light sectors may not automatically translate into the asset heavy sectors. And that's why it's a nuanced understanding of where digital and data and AI will play in terms of the value drivers, in terms of unleashing maybe new pockets of value that were hidden in the analog way of doing business that could now become much more relevant as we see pervasive digitization with programmable hardware, software, sensors, the cloud connectivity, and other things that, you know, we are all getting more familiar with on a daily basis.
In a way of thinking about it, the big tech companies, they have been very good at taking data that someone has already collected, and then they do things with that. But they are not very good at setting up the infrastructure to collect data when the data has not been collected for them. So they've pursued sectors and industries where it's easy to get hold of their data. But I can imagine working for a steel company, for example, or a rail company, for example, they would have to put in place the plumbing, the infrastructure to collect the data first. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think there's a very good way of thinking about it. Now, when we look at the last 15 years, ever since the pervasive availability of smartphones with the introduction of iPhone and then Android a few years after,
yes,
that single device now in the hands of nearly 4+ billion people on the planet provided the single easiest channel for people to collect data on how we live, work, play, yes, transact, govern, learn, and so on. So in the article that we wrote in the Harvard Business Review in 2022, we introduced this idea called the data graphs. And yes, the data graphs are really the ability of these big digital companies to observe real-time data on products in use at the point of interactions with the customers. Search graph that makes Google what it is. Social graph that makes Facebook or Meta what it is. Movie graph that makes Netflix succeed.
Yes.
Music graph that makes Spotify succeed. Professional graph that makes LinkedIn succeed. Mobility graph that makes Uber succeed. All of these are the ability to understand customers at the point of interactions with their products and services. But it all happened on the basis of one simple device that we carry around every day. That's a smartphone. Now, you mentioned steel.
Yes.
And you can look at other industries. there, the digitization is in the early stages.
Yes.
Companies have to invest in the infrastructure to understand steel in use or glass in use or chemistry in use, if you are BASF or any one of the chemical companies.
Yes.
And that will take some time. And I think that's where the investment thesis for the industrial companies become critical. They can't rely on a pervasive device like the smartphone. They've got to now figure out what is the investment that they need to make to understand the type of data that would allow them to then develop their digital strategies that allow them to unlock new value that they might not have unlocked in the past.
The Apple iPhone example is a great example because, in a manner of speaking, Apple did the difficult work of putting in place the infrastructure, the plumbing, and then everyone else leveraged the data that was being collected. But Apple built the physical product that connected everything. Now, if you go back to the industrial industries, I remember speaking to GE digital executives when they tried to tackle the digital space in the industry. And one of the big problems they encountered very quickly is that they struggled to build a common operating system or platform because all the different companies and different industries needed their own bespoke way of making the investments to collect the data. There was no one single platform they could use. So I could see this being very, very targeted with each industry trying to figure out a common operating system. Is that the challenge you're seeing as well?
Yeah, and I think GE is a good example. I think our analysis that GE was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And it could not justify the investment that it could make on behalf of its customers. And it's very similar to IBM Watson when it came up with the idea of trying to cure cancer. The underlying informational infrastructure was not there.
Yes.
Now, when you look at 2023 and look at large language models, the large language models are now the foundation on which we can build industry-specific models, company-specific models, and then the functional models, right? So yes. The large language models, which have essentially been built based on information from the internet, which is largely the asset-light sector, soon what we will see is the large language models becoming industrial foundation models, the language of lanes, to use Tesla's nomenclature, right?
Yes.
Their ability to understand how cars drive autonomously is going to allow them sometime in the near future to develop the large language models of lanes. And an agricultural company would then develop the large language models of farming. And a supply chain company could then develop the large language models of supply chain and demand chain. It could be a FedEx, it could be a UPS, it could yes. be a DHL. And once they start developing it, they realize that they can't think of this as restricted to their industry. And they got to now interconnect with other industries and ecosystem. And it'll get built out over the next few years. And that requires multiple sets of industries and multiple sets of companies to understand the power of large industrial foundation models. Now, when GE did it, there was one company that wanted to essentially try to create the internet
yes.
for the industry. And that's never going to happen because no one company is going to agree yes. to anyone monopolizing that. But I think 15 years later, maybe 10 years later, we are in a different situation where more and more executives are beginning to understand the power of large language models, and the industrial large language models are in the early stages of development.
There's a lot of fascinating things that I want to unpack a couple that are very important. The first one being is that let's take FedEx, use FedEx as an example. Let's assume FedEx builds the large language model for their industry, right? And they do a great job and you know they connect it with other things and so on. Wouldn't that mean that this creates an opening for a non-tech company to almost become the technology provider? I mean, what stops them from stopping in their lane when they could branch into other areas and compete with the tech companies? Because what I'm trying to figure out is that what gives the tech companies an advantage to win in these other areas?
Yeah. Again, history gives us a little bit of insight.
Yes.
When we look at advertising, the traditional advertising companies didn't understand the power of data and analytics.
Yes.
And then a search engine came and got monetized and then was monetized through advertising. The same thing with the music companies. The music executives understood data as produced and sold, not data as people listening. Similarly, the book publishers knew data as sold, not data as read. Movie companies knew data as shown in theaters, not data as watched. And the point I'm making very simply is that if a tech company can understand data at the point of use through a variety of devices and software and analytic capability under their control, then the traditional industrial companies will lose out. On the other hand, if the industrial companies understand the need to shift their frame from moving beyond products as designed and delivered to products as used and consumed, and they understand the power of that data, then they will make the investment thesis, and they have the subject area expertise to be able to interpret the data and come up with insights that the tech companies may not be able to do. And the tech companies understand this very well, right? If you look at Google and look at one part of Alphabet called Mineral, Mineral is basically trying to understand farming, but with data and AI at the core. Or if you look at Verily and Calico, the other part of Alphabet, they're trying to understand healthcare and aging with data and AI at the core. And if you look at Apple with its wearable devices, it's trying to understand health as we observe because we are wearing those devices in real time. So that clash between the digital companies, or what I wrote in my previous book, the digital giants entering into a marketplace, when that marketplace is becoming digital, changes the competitive landscape from traditional companies differentiating on the basis of their products and services to one in which the industrial companies compete with big digital giants that are able to bring their scale and scope, and then small startups funded by venture capitalists that have laser focused with narrow understanding that can scale up very fast, right? So that's why the competitive logic becomes important. There is nothing that actually prevents from a company like FedEx wanting to be much more of a digital logistics company that understands how things move and then provide value-added services to their logistics customers than simply reacting to the requirements of their customers.
There are two very important points you raised here, right? The first one is, let's keep the FedEx example going. As an executive team, I think the question they'd have to ask themselves is, what business are they in? Because if you just think of yourself as a logistics company moving things, then you almost discount the value of the data you could collect and what you could do with it. I think that's the first thing. And the second thing, we spoke about the clashes between the tech companies and industry and so on, and you know, who's going to make the first move, how they're going to monetize this, understand the value and so on. But the other one is also the clashes between the tech companies. Because I've spoken to executives from Google and so on who could not believe that even though in many ways they were first with large language models, they didn't find a way to capitalize on it. You know, there's so many moving pieces here that we often think of tech companies as so large, so established, no one's going to take them out. But there's so many things moving that it's creating many opportunities for the landscape to be radically rearranged over the next few years. Do you see that happening?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think this is the beauty of the digitally transformed industries and digitally transforming marketplaces.
Yes.
Is that we thought at one point in time, desktop was the be all and end all.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm sure you've seen cover stories that says the rise of Bill Gates, right? Of the Windows everywhere, and Windows had X percentage of the market share. And then the architecture of the technology shifted from PC to a mobile device. And they thought they can just take their Windows operating system and make it a mobile operating system for the smartphone, and that didn't happen.
Yes.
Similarly, Intel, that co-created the Intel architecture with Microsoft, then lost out to ARM and then now NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Then you've got Google that came in with search engine and then indexed the world and organized the world's information and make it useful and accessible for everyone through the search bar. And now we are shifting from the search bar to a prompt box. And then everyone else is coming into the search space, because once you index something, you can then shift the cash register somewhere else. So the tech companies themselves are realizing that the architecture that they thought they fully controlled is shifting right in front of them. And this architectural shift is extremely important for industrial companies to understand, to see whether their investment should be in hardware, should their investment be in the operating system, or in the application, or in the data and analytics space, and then where do they make the investment in the Gen AI space? And when industries digitize, their products, processes, services, and business models digitize, and that's why the tech companies and the industrial companies have to both compete and possibly collaborate and cooperate to unlock this value that is going to be made available.
Oh, that's very well said. I want to shift gears onto two other points that are directly related here, right? So I was speaking to a Department of Justice official, executive, whatever word you want to use. And we were talking about, given everything that's happening with AI and tech, lots of moving pieces, you know, how does the government get involved to make sure that as much as competition as possible exists and the healthiest companies rise to the top, as opposed to the one who simply has enough money to buy out competitors? And my thinking on this was that, you know, obviously prosecute crime, that's a given, but the role of the government here should be to keep things as open as possible, because if you do that, the competition will be so severe that it will force innovation, force changes. In other words, you don't need to regulate this to such an extent whereby the government thinks it can keep things open. The market will take care of it by itself. What's your perspective on the regulation side of everything that's happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you and I are very much in sync in terms of how we look at the role of regulators and the role of the government. IBM, the first antitrust, was because they wanted to open up the mainframe architecture to AMDAL. And they thought the mainframe is going to be so dominant that nobody else can come in. And then the architecture shifted from the mainframe to microcomputers with digital equipment and data general, and then subsequently to the PC, and subsequently to smart devices. And now we're going to have AI devices very soon. So that didn't go very far. Marketplace defined it. The next thing was an antitrust case against Microsoft. And part of it is because it bundled desktop with the Internet Explorer and tried to thwart competition from Netscape and then Google. And then we saw what happened with that antitrust case. And so I think what is happening is that none of these tech giants, the digital giants, are going to have an unfair monopoly for a very, very long time.
Yes.
Now, if they abuse their monopoly power, if they actually harm the consumer, then the regulators have to come in and say that is unacceptable. And we see interesting regulations from EU and the US and others about opening up and, you know, what can be opened up and what can be closed What can Apple Pay include? What can Apple Pay not use? What should be the role of the app stores in terms of allowing a third-party apps? And the pricing of the app store, all those are relevant questions for them to actually think about. But I feel that this is an area where Google's monopoly on search and their ability to monetize search, if regulators now think that they understand where the architecture of monetization of search is going,
yes,
when in fact the search may actually shift towards conversation, and the entire internet, which is based on URLs, where we go from one website to the other website using URL, which then gave rise to clicks.
Yes.
And the architecture of the internet was based on clicks, is now shifting to architecture that's based on conversation and knowledge. Then the role of advertising shifts, and Google may not be the one that is in the dominant position of advertising. Maybe the monetization logic shift from advertising to subscriptions, and maybe somebody else subsidizing that subscription because they want to collect data on the consumer. So the regulators will find that they're regulating by assuming the extrapolation of the architecture that they know, rather than act proactively regulate to understand where the competition is going to be in the future. Regulation is always looking back. And I think the pace of technology and the speed of change is such that regulators will always make a mistake. And this is where I said, we can go back and look at IBM, and we can go back and look at what happened to Microsoft. While both of them agreed to certain conditions, but ultimately it's the marketplace that dictated who was going to dominate.
Yeah, that's very well said, because every Department of Justice action is going to be litigating the past, because these things take so long to play out in courts. And as you very well said, is that nobody can predict what's going to happen over the next few years. I mean, we'd love to think we can do that, but we don't know. So, you know, the good example that I always use to explain how to get an industry to grow rapidly is the example of how the Chinese brought in Tesla to supercharge their EV market. Yeah. And it forced Chinese companies to learn and adapt to a fierce competitor. And that's how they kickstarted the EV sector, which is doing really well today, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think ultimately, if you allow competition to have an even playground, and the venture capitalists are able to provide the seed capital, and then you got private equity companies, and then the public market that understands what's happening. All we have to do is just look at what's happened in the last 6 months with the AI chip companies.
Yes.
That is something we could not have understood looking back, you know, a year back, because we didn't know how fast Gen AI investment is going to accelerate. And we have no idea what's going to happen with, you know, vision computing and the next generation of quantum computing and others that can come into the industry and start to redefine science-based competition, right? We have barely touched deep science-based competition. We're still talking about disruption that is happening in asset-light sectors like advertising and media and so on. So what happens when deep science get digitized, right? And so then who's going to have the monopoly on personalized medicine? Who's going to have the monopoly when it comes to personalized education?
Yes.
Who's going to have monopoly when it comes to energy sector, which is largely a digital play with different types of energy, extraction, generation, and distribution that's going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years.
Yes, and the interesting thing about this is that even the guys at OpenAI who invented ChatGPT, when they launched it, they didn't think it would be successful. They weren't expecting this breakout product that's going to be the third fastest company in the world to make $1 billion in revenue. They thought they'll roll it out, see what happens, and maybe find a new project, right? So the point is that even for the people who are really in the space and understand it, it's impossible to predict and know what will happen.
Exactly. I mean, I think OpenAI ChatGPT is a great example. But it also ties back to what you raised earlier, which is, if you think about OpenAI by itself, it's a different animal than OpenAI when it's combined with the power of Microsoft, right?
Yes, good point.
Right? So OpenAI by itself, with the UX that it has, and the kinds of the lack of support that they actually provide to the users, that would not take off as much as the fact that Microsoft is going to be the distribution arm that is going to sit on top of Windows and Office and connected to the Azure cloud. That makes OpenAI a formidable competitor, right? And so there we can look and say, it's a strategic decision made by Satya Nadella to actually take the risk to announce the Copilot, even in its early form, to test out the market, to test out the market and get a lead over Google's, Gemini, Bard, and then now it's Gemini. Because at that point in time, I think the Microsoft board should get a little bit of credit for allowing Satya Nadella to shift the narrative of competition away from search and browser as we know it, to actually begin to think about the next evolution of that architecture, to shift from search box or a search bar to a prompt box. In the last 12 months is the competitive logic. It's now Microsoft's Copilot is a prompt box that allows productivity and creativity to be combined in ways that previous digital technologies haven't done. Most of the previous technologies focused on productivity of professionals. For the first time, we have a generation of technologies that are combining productivity and creativity. And and that's a shift in the architecture that none of the government agencies could have regulated or even saw early on.
Given the way Satya speaks, I would love to have been in that boardroom when he was making the case. Because, we always talk about the technology. The technology is amazing, can do things that we haven't been able to do before. But the point that is often missed in innovation is that the battle doesn't end when you develop something. It's about finding a way to distribute it, to get it to everyone, to make it second nature that you use these things. And Microsoft picked it up very quickly and ran with it because they do have a reputation for being slow to pursue new avenues of growth. But the technology is only as good as the scale of distribution you have. And I think Microsoft hit that on the head and they deserve full credit for that.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely, absolutely right. It would have been a very interesting discussion on whether they should announce that with all the problems of a new technology, especially with hallucination, right?
Yes.
Which goes at the heart of trustworthiness in the information. But then they played the bets by saying, okay, there is always going to be hallucination till the models are trained. But the waiting game, right? It's the waiting equation that is so critical in technology, which is, should I invest now or should I invest next year? I know that if I invest next year, the technology will be clearer and more well understood. But then I missed the first mover advantage, right? So he decided that he's going to go to the first mover advantage and take that risk, and then knowing full well that the Microsoft engine will then improve all that is happening with the Gen AI over the last 12 months. And that's where I think the board deserves the credit for putting the reputation of the company on the line. And today it's the largest capitalized company in the world.
That's the discussion about technology that's almost never had. It's about the governance and the decisions you make to allocate capital. And as you said, it's a good point. They're putting the reputation of the company on the line and they're making this bet. And a good example to compare this is Toyota, because I remember speaking to Toyota executives and reading about them in the press. They made the choice to not go all in on electric because for a long time they felt it wasn't the only option and the technology was not as developed as it could be. And now, even if they want to make the jump into electric, they're really far behind.
Yes. And, in that case, they had the hybrid. They were the absolute global leader in hybrid. They wanted to protect hybrid.
Exactly.
And didn't want to give up the lead that they had with hybrid. And, you know, and again, if you're cautious, you'll say, we don't have electric grids, we don't have charging infrastructure, and we're still going to have, you know, people that are driving 50, 60 miles a day, and for them, plug-in hybrid is better than, you know, full electric and so on and so forth. You can make all the cases for why plug-in hybrid is going to be a viable alternative and the electric is going to be fringe. And that's what they did. And it's similar to, I think, if you look at what Google might have been thinking about in terms of Gen AI and its own, there's still going to be search. We are now getting, you know, 2 to 3 billion people, you know, come to Google and search. And Android is still a very dominant play. Let's wait and watch and make sure that we have our models that are as robust as possible before we slowly migrate to go from search. And then they were caught, you know, pretty much flat-footed when Microsoft announced the thing with ChatGPT and OpenAI, and they're responding, right? And they're responding reasonably well. It'll be interesting to see in the next 6 months how, you know, Google Gemini does against ChatGPT-5 and every other combination that we can think of. But the strategic logic of investing in the technology is nearly as important as the understanding of the technology itself. And here we got to look at both the supply side of the technology and then the demand side of the technology. And that's why I go back to, if you look at IBM Watson, from a technology point of view, was really very powerful, but then they require companies to make significant investment in digitizing so that Watson can be trained on that corpus of data. 10 years later, the large language models exist, so I can now sit on top of it and create the cure for cancer, or, you know, decode the human genome and do other things. And that's why I'm very excited about deep science and digitization of industries, which I think will start to unlock significant amount of value in the next decade or so.
You've raised a point that I don't see being discussed much, because if you look at ChatGPT, Gemini, Bard, and all these things, right? They are trained on publicly available data, largely. But the most valuable data we have usually sits in some company's warehouse somewhere, and it's not available to the public. I wonder what's going to happen when that data starts getting digitized, that's being fed into large language models. I mean, it's going to be incredible when you have that highly vetted, high-quality data feeding models, because that's not what we have now.
Yeah, you know, I'm smiling because if all that we know about human beings is what we have written and how we have interacted on the web, and much of that is what this this intelligent engines are trying to understand and interpret, then we have a very narrow view of deep sciences, right?
Absolutely.
Right. And even if you take all of the science, what is written is the output of science.
Yes.
Many, many things in the pharmaceutical labs are not publicly available.
Exactly.
Anything that the researchers have been working on in many, many labs are all private information. Right. And so as these companies start to digitize their information, digitize their knowledge, we will start to see that they will have to share that knowledge information from others in order to get back the benefit of economies of expertise rather than economies of scale in production or economies of scope in complementary asset. When you look at economies of expertise, and there are just early attempts are being done, right? Google has, commons, data commons, where they're trying to get as much information that can be, with a common basis, can connect across different industries like climate and food and water and other things to make it available. But they barely scratch the surface. But once that happens, where people realize that I can now give you data on the steel processing for the last 15 years.
Yes.
Or as L'Oreal, really interesting company to look at. L'Oreal as a company saying, we are going to be a digital company that understands beauty tech, right? And because we can now take all that we know about face and skin care and cosmetics, that, you know, 100 plus years of data that exists in the lab, and start to then make it available to come up with personalized products for individuals. And they make beauty tech data at some level available to others to build upon. And let's say Procter & Gamble does the same thing and Nestle does the same thing. Then suddenly the digitization of beauty as an industry will become more widely understood. And that's what I call by digitizing deep science. And the pieces are all in place, right? If you look at farming today, and I'm sure you've looked at farming as an industry, when Climate Corporation, and when Monsanto bought Climate Corporation for $1.6 billion, mm-hmm. you know, about more than 10 years back, people said, why is Monsanto buying this very small company that, for, you know, had 25 or 30 climate scientists? They paid $1.6 billion. It's not the 30 scientists. It's all the data that they had digitized on the farm in terms of rainfall, yes, on every hectare of farm on the, in the US. Now, that data is valuable because Climate Corporation uses the data to come up with crop insurance. What better crop insurance data than micro-level data on the rainfall of every hectare of the farm in the US? Because once you have the data, you can now come up with the best insurance premium, right? Now, they took that data, and then obviously with now at Bayer, they now got field view, where they got field-level data with agronomy data, with weather data, and everything else to figure out how to improve the yield on the farm, right? Now, that is extremely important, but these pieces have existed for 10 years. Now it's getting integrated, right? And that's where the deep science comes in. And we're going to now digitize the physical world and then overlay that on, like I call, the language of lanes, or the, yeah, language of farms, or the language of buildings. You know, how do we get climate tech to make sure that our buildings are as energy efficient as possible and take protection against other sets of extraneous risks and so on? That is going to be fascinating to see who steps up into that world, right? Who has this audacious goal of what Google did when it said, we want to organize world's information, yes, and make it useful and accessible, and then we're going to monetize it with advertising. Who's the next one that says, we're going to now digitize the entire food supply chain, or the oil and the energy demand chain, or logistics supply chain, and make it much more efficient and resilient and useful? We will see some interesting combination of companies in this particular space.
And I think the part that is missing when people have this discussion is they forget that Google is only arranging what is publicly available. And the really exciting stuff is the stuff that's not publicly available, that's now going to be used to train these models. And switching gears a little bit here, so the company we own, it produces a lot of the intellectual property used in management consulting firms. And when ChatGPT came out and many firms realized that they need high quality data to train their large language models, I remember we got approached by several consulting firms that wanted to acquire our database. I think what AI has shown us is that having high quality data now becomes a major battlefield. Because if you don't have the data, how do you train these things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we got to look at the high quality data that can be reverse engineered, high quality data that can be substituted with synthetic data, and high quality data that is the deep science, deep embedded, deep subject area understanding of the phenomenon. The last bit is really where it's going to be valuable, right? Because there's a lot of data that can be reverse engineered. Yeah. There's a lot of data that can be simulated. You can do synthetic data and the analysis. But when you have deep understanding of how things are happening and at a level that cannot be reverse engineered, that's where I think the value added is going to happen in the next few years. Let's just go back to a simple case. If you look at Uber and say, okay, now obviously it's now profitable, it's doing well, but it's sitting on 25
yes.
billion rides on in 10,000 cities over the last 10 years, right? It has the best data on how cities move. And now it's better data than any of the city planners will have individually. But they also understand the conditions under which variations happen in terms of why cities move differently on a Monday morning in June and Monday morning in July yes. and Monday morning in December, right? That data, it cannot be reverse engineered. That is the deep science data that they have in terms of how cities move. Now look at what they're doing. They're now asking people to book their train tickets. They're asking people to then, you know, book yeah. On Hertz and Avis, not because they want to get a share of that booking fee. They want to get data on how people move. That's the deep science data on how individuals move. And once they start accumulating that data, you can now say, what can they do in that space? They have an understanding of the best transportation option for individuals that they can predict, which means they can get into a subscription model without the fear of them losing profitability, because they got a much better way to hedge, similar to what Climate Corporation did in terms of coming up with the crop insurance, because they had the best rainfall and climate data on the farm, right?
Yes.
Those are the value pockets that's going to become available to companies in ways that we couldn't do before in the analog world.
We've reached a point whereby as nations compete, you know, during the Cold War, you'd have the Soviet Union sending spies to steal designs for stealth missiles and so on. That's still going to happen, I'm sure. But we're reaching a point
yes.
where stealing the right kind of data is going to become a spycraft.
Yeah, people are going to be hunting for it. And when people don't get it, that's where the idea of synthetic data and reverse engineering will get to maybe 70% and 80%, because in the absence of not knowing the data, how can I abstract and approximate that enough for me to be credible in the space, right? And this is really what's happening with, you know, ChatGPT versus
yeah.
Google Gemini versus others. Each one has got a certain amount of data that's public, and then they're going to start licensing for other important data, right? OpenAI
yes.
did it with Axel Springer in Germany to get licensed to their data as a publishing company. New York Times will ultimately settle somewhere, you know, the Harvard Business Review with its content over the last 100 years, Simon & Schuster and all of these publishers at some point in time will license this data to others in order to get that. Similarly, the scientific journals and the scientific community will start sharing the data and licensing the data. So if we cannot license the data, then people are going to try to, you know, rely on espionage and others.
Yeah.
But the competition for data and access to relevant, timely data rather than the data that is 3 years old or 5 years old is going to become more and more valuable. And we'll see, you know, we'll see how the different data owners actually play in this space in the future.
You know, this is a great thing about capitalism, right? Right now, there's all this talk about NVIDIA and spending, I think Sam Altman wants to spend $7 trillion on chips, right? But there's going to come a time, and it always happens in technologies, that the chip is going to be important, but it's not going to be where the battle is. It's going to be who holds the right kind of data. And you're going to see this whole industry of licensing data, like the way we license chip designs, right? That's amazing. That's
yeah.
how the world works. You can never yeah. predict where things go, but you know it's going to change.
Yeah. I think when the e-commerce era, when we said Amazon versus Alibaba, and we said Alibaba has an edge because of the domestic marketplace in which it's playing, where it has the best data in understanding how the Chinese consumers buy, which is absolutely true, right? There's no way in which Amazon will be able to do. But if that market is completely bifurcated, where nobody else is going to come and play in China, then obviously the Chinese companies have that access to the data. And that is such a siloed operation that what happens in China cannot be generalized to the rest of the world. Barring that aside, this is going to be an important way for US, Western Europe, China, and also increasingly a place like India, which has got, you know, 800 to 900 million people that are beginning to use smartphones to do very many things that have not been digitized that much, that will all get digitized. And over the next 3 to 5 years, we'll see fascinating ways in which people develop an understanding of how systems operate, understanding how value can be delivered, created, captured, and distributed, all on the basis of really powerful chip. But more than the chip infrastructure will be the access to the data. And you know, back to the $7 trillion. Now, I don't know whether that was a $7 trillion over, you know, 10 years, whether $7 trillion over the next 20 years. We don't know what the time frame of the investment. I think what I took away from that is really the ambition to think about the next generation architecture of the AI chip that is going to be in every part of the infrastructure, from individuals to cars to planes to missiles to energy to healthcare to whatever else. Now, if you look at that, $7 trillion, even on annualized basis, is really very small because the world GDP is $100 trillion, right? If the world's GDP is $100 trillion, and we're going to now think about the transformation of that GDP, the engine that is going to transform that $100 trillion GDP to grow at 10-15% as people expect with the Gen AI part, then something like $1 trillion worth AI chip, and let's say the $7 trillion is over 7 years, $1 trillion annualized investment in a chip infrastructure on a $100 trillion infrastructure is really a very small amount, right? If you think about it in that context.
It's not going to move the
like
needle
like the
much.
Other infrastructure, right? Infrastructure in planes, infrastructure in airports, infrastructure in high-speed train. If you start adding up all that, that stock of infrastructures happened over 50 years after Second World War. That has given us the infrastructure on how goods and people move. If information has to move at a much faster speed and rate, then $1 trillion or $2 trillion investment in the infrastructure needed to accelerate the value that can be unlocked is not that far-fetched if you think about it in that context.
Can you just imagine what the leaders of China are thinking, Taiwan, because it's an issue of geopolitical significance. It's going to determine how countries compete and who benefits from the new economy, right? It keeps people up at night.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had certain assumptions about outsourcing and offshoring.
Yes.
As the new world order, with China coming into the World Trade Organization, China becoming an important part of the globalized world, that assumption has now been challenged as we get to new polarization that's happening in geopolitics. In that assumption, there was not a problem in having the relatively low value added being done by TSMC in Taiwan because the chip design was in the US and manufacturing was done elsewhere. It's like looking at an Apple product and saying designed by Apple in California and assembled in China. But now it's a very different product in a very different world. And so that geopolitical assumption is being challenged. And the next set of assumptions will guide where we make the investment and who actually wins in the short term and who actually then gets an edge to win in the longer term.
Well said, Venkat. Thank you so much. We could speak for hours. Well, I know everyone that's going to listen to this is going to love it, but I hope executives listen to this and ask themselves those important questions. Thank you so much for this wonderful discussion, Venkat.
Thank you very much. Very much enjoyed it.
Have a great day, and we'll be in touch and speak soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
As we wrap up, today's podcast is sponsored by strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies as a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you're looking to advance your career and need to update your resume, you can get a McKinsey and BCG winning resume template example as a free download at www.firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF.